You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep and we look to the future and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. But today I'm delighted to have the chance to talk to one of the world's leading figures when it comes to climate change, public health, and transformation in the global food system. She's founder and executive chair at EAT, the global non-profit platform for food system transformation. EAT's vision is a fair and sustainable global food system, leaving no one behind, which is no mean feat. She works with the United Nations, the World Economic Forum, and UNICEF, to name a few. In 2019, she was the recipient of the UN Foundation's Global Leadership Awards. There are few people who can offer such a deep insight into the global food system, which is, let's face it, in need of radical change to make it fit for the future. My guest is, of course, Dr. Gunhild Stordalen. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Stefan. What an
a lot of words, wasn't it? A lot of words. Now, we'll come to the challenges of the global food system in a moment. But first of all, just to sort of get ourselves started, just tell me, what would your ideal meal be? If you could just choose one dish or maybe a place or people to have it with, how would you like to eat, ideally?
That's an easy one to start with. I mean, normally, who's around the table, to me, are even more important than what's actually on the plate. Yeah. But if I should pick one dish, I guess it would be lots of different grilled vegetables, perhaps with some pan-seared scallops or some fish and some pine nuts, for example, and lots of olive oil. I mean, I could feed on that every day.
Excellent. Okay. All right. You've set the scene for us. That's all good. So let's talk about your own journey, first of all. You're from a medical background, aren't you? You've got a PhD in orthopedic surgery. What took you from that to environmentalism and towards the food industry?
Well, that's a great question, because, I mean, as a now basically a retired medical doctor, it wasn't obvious that I would end up in the food space. But I grew up in the rural countryside in Norway with animals as best friends and nature as playground. And I learned to love nature, and I also learned about all the damage that we as humanity were inflicting on the planet. So I decided early on, when I was at the age of 7, that I wanted to spend my life trying to make the most positive change that I possibly could. So I actually started out being concerned about climate change, and I went into the medical field first and foremost, actually, to get a voice, to be respected in the public debate. And then I happened to marry a hospitality tycoon, running a lot of hotels. And suddenly I found myself on the board of one of the largest hotel companies in Scandinavia. And then, obviously, I knew nothing about business, but as an environmental activist and also as a medical doctor, I wanted to use that seat to run the hotels more sustainable, and started to look into the literature. So what are the biggest sustainability challenges for the industry? And then I was so surprised to see that food and beverage turned out to be accountable for as much as 70% of an average hotel's environmental footprint. So then the next question was, obviously, how can we get it right for our guests and employees, right for the planet, and obviously right for the people producing our food and all the animals in the supply chain?
And then you moved towards founding EAT. And so, I mean, even though you're fascinated by that area, it's a big leap, isn't it? How did that first come about? And yeah, what's the journey been like?
Well, it has been a hell of a journey, to be honest. I mean, really, really exciting, an amazing journey. But at that point, I stumbled into the food-related challenges through the board of the hotel company. I mean, there was no answers. I was as a scientist, I said to the executive team that give me a couple of days. I mean, I'm a scientist. I will find some reports that could underpin some internal guidelines for food that is good for us and good for our planets. And I then had to come back a week later, so frustrated, saying that it's literally nothing that is looking across all these different issues that food is obviously at the heart of. And neither did I find any platform, any arena where all the different stakeholders that obviously had to be part of finding solutions could meet. And then I picked up the phone and called the smartest man I know, which is Professor Johan Rockström. At the time, he was the director of the Stockholm Resilience Center. And I told him about the knowledge gap and also the gap of platforms or arenas for multi-stakeholder collaboration. And that was basically the start of EAT. So we held our first EAT Stockholm Food Forum in 2014 with 400 delegates from across the world with Bill Clinton on stage. And that was really the start of our convenings. And then obviously we decided that we had to commission some synthesis science looking across and trying to find answers how to feed 10 billion people, which the population will reach by 2050, how to feed the growing population enough healthy, safe food within safe planetary boundaries. So that became the start of the Eat Lancet Commission that came out in 2019 and which has had massive impact since then.
Yeah. And I guess one of the principles about change and about being able to improve what you're doing is you've got to be able to analyze it. You've got to have the data of what where you're at to begin with. And lacking that must be so frustrating, which is why that pushed you into diving into this whole area.
That's the thing, right? And when I started looking into these issues in 2011, 2012, and I mean, realized that there was no scientific targets. There was no plan whatsoever for the world. Obviously, I realized that this was something that not only a hotel company in Scandinavia needed to find answers to, but really the world. It was even before the Sustainable Development Goals were adopted, because that happened in 2015. But when that happened, it became very clear that without getting it right on food, there is no chance that we will be able to deliver on these 17 goals. And now with the Paris Climate Agreement, food is one third of the climate problem and obviously has to be at least one third of the solutions. Mm. So getting it right on food is absolutely essential for the future of humanity on this planet. But we need to let science guide our actions, period.
Yeah. But so let's talk about change, because change hurts, doesn't it? For a lot of big companies and organizations, you know, we're looking at issues with a global food system, but the sheer scale of what we're talking about means that to do something about it is a Sisyphean task. You know, it's endless problems being thrown at you, people that don't want to change. Have there been times when you questioned whether you can affect real change, or are you just constantly searching for ways to pull it off?
Well, we are about to change the biggest economy on the planet. I mean, food and beverage accounts for up to 30% of the global value creation, and changing that with all its entrenched and vested interests is not an easy task. But at the same time, food is such an amazing entry point for systems transformation, because it cuts across all these 17 sustainable development goals. It connects global agendas and it connects the global issues down to something that every single person on our planet cares about, has a relationship to, and that really unites and excites. So to me, the power of food is really about the power of bringing unprecedented collaboration forward and driving massive progress towards the SDGs. And of course, it has been times where I doubt that it's possible. But since we started EAT in 2014, I mean, look what has happened, right? And obviously, we haven't been alone. More and more actors have been waking up and been smelling the roses of the opportunities for systems transformation through the lens of food, and have been jumping on the food systems bandwagon. It was, for example, the first ever UN Food Systems Summit being hosted by Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, in September last year, where basically the world came together to address these issues and how do we fix food within this decade? How do we create healthy, sustainable, and socially just and equitable food systems? So all the massive responses, all the interest in this field, all the people now wanting to be part of change, that is overshadowing all the interest in blocking progress. So I'm very, very confident that transformation will happen.
Okay. So which are the areas that you think are most problematic? Because I worry that a lot of things that we all say, including me, become mantras that people don't hear because they've been said so many times. From your point of view, what are the key things that are wrong with the global food system? And which are the bits that most need to be fixed?
I mean, right now, food is literally failing both people and planets. I mean, food has become the biggest killer in the world. Bad diets, poor diets is responsible for 11 million deaths every year globally, and is now a bigger killer than alcohol, tobacco, drugs, and unsafe sex combined. Hunger is on the rise again after more than a decade of steady decline, mainly due to conflict and climate change. And food is the biggest driver of climate change and environmental degradation. At the same time, like we've seen now with the pandemic, the way we are continuing to unsustainably expand agricultural land and destroying natural ecosystems, and the way we are producing industrial cheap meat are also driving up the risk for zoonotic spillover and new pandemics. So we have a massive health and environmental crisis driven by food. And then on top of that, we have the social injustice in the food system with still 500 million smallholder farmers living below the poverty line and food workers along the value chain being under minimum wage. So there is a huge social justice aspect to this as well. But the beauty of food being at the heart of the health, the climate, environmental and social challenges we are facing is also that food is the solution to fix it.
Yeah.
And by fixing food, we can also prevent the root causes. And that is where I believe that once we present the big picture around food, once we present the science that is so clearly showing all these synergies across human health and planetary health, and that it actually can be done, that is socially just. I mean, that's the most compelling case, and really the scientific underpinning of getting it right on food is to provide the most efficient, powerful preventative medicine for people and planet with multiple co-benefits.
Hello there, only me. I just want to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out another one where we asked, how do you persuade people to move to a more sustainable diet? It's a great episode, and it was made with Dr. Giles Yeo and Dr. Hazel Wallace. To find it, visit foodmatterslive.com and search sustainable diets. And now, back to the chat. So, I mean, you've got a unique position to be able to answer this question. What are the biggest obstacles to change? Is it big business? Is it politics, culture? Is it the diffusion of knowledge? What's the thing that's holding things back most, do you think?
Well, I mean, again, this is the biggest economy on the planet, and the biggest obstacles to meaningful change are really the entrenched thinking and the vested interests that's surround the food systems. And it's really about all those profiting from status quo, all those making money from what is driving obesity, diet-related diseases, climate change, and benefiting on extracting natural resources in an unsustainable way. And for sure, there are many that are doing what they can to put the brakes on meaningful transformation, whether that is the interests behind industrial meat production or those peddling in unhealthy ultra-processed foods and beverages. I mean, we have now, over the past 8-9 years, seen all kinds of efforts to undermine and to distract and questioning the science and cause division here, polarizing polarizing the debates.
And to talk us specifically about division, I guess, it's almost impossible not to talk about this subject without reference to the current geopolitics. We're on day 20 or so of the war in Ukraine, tensions, uncertainty elsewhere in the world. Now, does this increase the need for us to stop and reimagine the food system in a slightly different way, again, with a food security twist? And do you worry that the sort of shock to the food system from conflict in Ukraine, which is a massive supplier of food in various different markets, will change everything, and the advances that you have been making will either be put on hold, or people will say, okay, stop, we've got to sort this out first, and thereby those entrenched interests will find another foothold to drag themselves, to slow down the pace of change?
Thank you, Stefan. This is really, really important, and it's a big question. But I must say, first and foremost, my heart goes out to the people of Ukraine who are now suffering under the most unimaginable and horrific circumstances. And it's criminal that abuse of power continue to happen in 2022. And it's so important that the international community stand firm against Putin and his criminal invasion of Ukraine. And I think that is really happening. Putin has achieved one positive thing since the invasion started, that the world has united and united against him.
Yeah.
In terms of reimagining the food systems, it's true about these global events, from the pandemic really to the war in Ukraine, that these events are bringing stark evidence of the vulnerabilities of our food systems and all the weaknesses and how interdependent we are on each other. And what is worrying is that right now, food self-sufficiency as a policy objective, that appears now to take precedence over the need to transform food systems to make them more sustainable, more resilient. Resilient value chains are so important, and obviously also to make food systems delivering healthy, safe food in an inclusive way.
Yeah.
And higher food prices that we are seeing now are obviously bringing significant hardships to the poorest and the most vulnerable, particularly at a time with concurrent higher energy prices. But the short-term food self-sufficiency goals that many policymakers or many governments are now putting forward, that really risk undermining their own sustainability in the medium to long term.
And just for our listeners, to put this in a context, I think what we're saying is that food self-sufficiency means that you won't necessarily be growing food at the optimal conditions. You'll be growing something that somewhere else in the world it might be grown more efficiently. And so food self-sufficiency could mean that our climate goals are set aside because we think, let's get food security sorted first. Is that right?
Yeah, that is one dimension of this. And obviously, some degree of self-sufficiency is more and more important as well because of, climate change is already happening, more extreme weather events, and having breadbasket failures or failure of crops in these breadbaskets that are very much feeding the world will mean that, that is a risk that we need to compensate with having some sort of a minimum self-sufficiency in most countries. But global trade will be important also in a global climate and nature perspective. So it's to find the right balance. And obviously here, as always, we need to also let science inform and guide our way. But I think what is really an acute danger now with the current crisis is that we risk taking several steps back and doing more of what we have done in the past to secure immediate food security in the narrow term without thinking that it has to be nature positive. It has to be providing healthy, safe food to everybody everywhere. And we cannot afford to take the shortcuts that are undermining health, sustainability and equality in the next round. So the immediate actions has to be sustainable in the long term. That is what I'm trying to say.
So some of the proactive things that EAT have been working on are things like the planetary health diet. Mm. Can you tell us a little bit about it and what the thinking is behind it?
So I briefly mentioned the EAT Lancet Commission that basically was the answer to the question that made Johan Rockström and myself start EAT in the first place. And the recommendation from the commission was the planetary health diet, a global framework for or a optimal healthy reference diet that 10 billion people actually can eat without transgressing these 9 planetary boundaries, or actually food is only transgressing 5 of them. But basically what the scientists did was to divide this up in several chunks. So the first chunk was about what is a optimal healthy reference diet for adults in terms of calories and grams of different food groups per day. And the second chunk was what is the maximum environmental footprint that could come from food production in terms of the 5 planetary boundaries that food is affecting. So obviously climate, water use, land use, biodiversity loss, and nitrogen and phosphorus, the nutrients. Mm. And then the third chunk was to ask if we take the median values of this healthy reference diet and then calculate whether 10 billion people can eat this reference diet within safe planetary boundaries. And the conclusion from this landmark report was that, yes, it is possible, but it will require a radical transformation of current food systems. So the way we produce, consume, and of course also waste and lose food along the value chain.
Yeah. And again, this comes back to change and ability to change. And when you come up against culture, and a lot of cultures have very set ways in which they eat, it's tricky, isn't it? So have you been working on those solutions and how to affect societal change?
Yeah, and just to start with, I mean, this is one of the most common and widespread misunderstandings around the EAT Lancet report and the planetary health diets. This has been perceived as one global diet that is going to be imposed on people everywhere. And that is absolutely not the case. This is a framework that has to be translated, that has to be adapted and tailored to different regions, different countries, different cultures and religions, and even individual preferences. So it's a lot of flexibility, a lot of swapping of different food groups can happen. And it's something that can actually be applied in any region around the world, any culture and any cuisine. And it's also really important to say that this is not a vegan, it's not a vegetarian diet, it's a plant-rich diet. You can do fully plant-based or fully vegan if you like and if you plan carefully, but it's also room for animal proteins just in moderation. It recommends minimizing or eliminating ultra-processed foods that are loaded with added sugar, salt, fats, etc.
And to put this into effect and to achieve change at scale, do we need governments to step in and add their weight in terms of regulation and guiding business, either by taxation or by subsidies, to change their ways?
Yeah, I mean, this is an absolutely yes to that question. People in power, namely governments, need to recognize the problem we are facing related to food and obviously the urgency of this challenge, and they need to start listening to and acting on the science. So this is why EAT, together with our partners around the world, are literally working around the clock to build awareness, to demand major shifts in policies and really driving policy reforms, but also in business practice. And these two need to happen in parallel. And one key challenge which has contributed to where we are and the mess we are in is that policy is siloed into different government ministries. Mm-hmm. There is lack of integrated, holistic policymaking across agriculture, health, climate, environment, education, social protection, etc., etc. And this has to change. So governments must, as an urgent priority, come up with integrated food systems strategies. And governments also need to start to base their policies on the true cost or the true value of food. Because today, food prices do not account for the full positive and negative consequences of different food choices. I mean, if we take that as an example, the burger menu that you can buy at any fast food restaurant, if we look across health, climate, environments, and the social dimensions, is everything but cheap. The price does not reflect the hidden costs across different areas.
Absolutely, yeah. And somebody absorbs that, and it's generally us at some level. So what's interesting really is a couple of things that you've said that really, really crop up. You talked about collaboration earlier on. You were just talking about how difficult it is to integrate disconnected departments and policies in government. It's this issue, isn't it, as getting people to work together, which must be, I mean, bloody hell, it's the biggest task, isn't it? Do you see EAT as essentially in its sort of backroom role as a framework within which you can try and get people to work together, to collaborate, to integrate?
I mean, we are saying over and over again that the most difficult of the 17 sustainable development goals is really number 17, partnerships and collaboration for the goals. Yeah. And it's like leadership. I mean, leadership is easy if it wasn't for all the people. Collaboration is easy if it wasn't for
so all annoying, all these bloody people.
Yeah. No, but it's both the most challenging, but also the most rewarding and the most promising way forward. And back to the beauty of the complexity of food is that it's an entry point for stakeholders from across the board, from all walks of life, to really come in and find their thing, find their pet's cause through the lens of food systems, because it's so broad, it spans across everything. Mm-hmm. And yes, there are important trade-offs that must be considered and must be minimized, but it's overwhelmingly more synergies that can be unlocked. And the only way to change a system is by working together. And we need policy change, we need business action, we need to change investments and flow of capital, and we need to change the bottom-up demand. We need to fuel that bottom-up movement that we are already seeing, especially in parts of the world. And all of this must happen in parallel within the next 8 years, or at least getting well underway. So it's a massive task. But again, I think what we have seen over the past 8-9 years since we started EAT, I mean, is a massive mindset shift that we have seen. And also the UN Food Systems Summit, where EAT and I were leading on Action Track 2 on shifting to sustainable consumption patterns, obviously also healthy consumption patterns. Mm. As a result of that summit, more than 100 countries have now embarked on national pathways to sustainable, healthy, equitable food systems by 2030. Right now, these pathways are a mixed bag. Many are quite fluffy and without concrete commitments, but it's a starting point. Yeah. And I think we now, with the current crisis, with the pandemic we are still in, crises are great opportunities to rethink and shift course.
Yeah, reset.
So reset and reboot. So I remain a stubborn optimist. And again, all the different interests that are converging through the lens of food makes me believe that it is possible to do this within a decade, really.
Yeah. And what about individuals? What about the consumers and the people who actually eat the food? I mean, is there power in consumer choice? Is it in electing leaders that you know, is it about the vote? What can they do to affect all this?
I mean, all of what you just said, consumers, well, I prefer citizens, people. And as Bono once said, people today have so much more power than the people in power. And I think he is really spot on here.
Yeah, yeah.
We know that, I mean, governments, policymakers, they all know what to do, more or less. They just don't know how to get reelected once they have done it, right? And business people, like Richard Branson has said, nobody is really going to want to change the world before they can make profit doing it. So back to the power and also individual responsibility is really to put pressure, to use your votes to the rights and visionary policymakers or political parties, and also to use our buying power, our consumer power, when we are in the grocery store or buying food, because yeah. We see that business investors are responding so fast to consumer demands. But obviously today it's also important to say that it's not easy to be a consumer. It's so overwhelming, and it's also an example where we need clear labeling, where it brings also different dimensions of the considerations we need to make. I mean, healthy, sustainable, socially just, good for the farmers, good for animal health and welfare, etc., etc. We need really to make it easier and empower consumers to make the right decisions.
And that's making the metrics possible to understand. It's blockchain. Yeah. It's a whole bunch of different things that need to be thrown into it.
Exactly.
So last couple of questions. Let's look ahead. COP27 is taking place in Egypt this November. World again is coming together for a climate change conference. What have you learned from COP26 last year in Glasgow, and how are you approaching COP27 on the back of that?
It's a really important point. I took the train from Oslo to Glasgow.
Very good. Well done.
Yes, because I thought it was easy to take the train to an island, but because I wanted to really walk the talk and reflect that we are in a crisis modus.
Yeah.
And obviously the only reason that my EAT colleagues and I took the trip was because we now know that we cannot, there is absolutely no path to avoiding a catastrophic runaway climate change without transforming both food production and food consumption and ending food waste and food loss. Mm. I mean, it should go without saying that we cannot ignore a full one third of the climate problem if we are to solve it, right? So that was why we were in Glasgow. And although there was an increasing number of actors outside the negotiation rooms really talking about it, it was absent on the negotiation table. It's still not part of the process. Countries are still not integrating food systems into their national climate plans, the so-called nationally determined contributions, which is absolutely unheard of given what we know. And we know that tackling climate change, it's about energy transition and the food system transformation. Rest is footnotes, really.
Yeah.
So we saw an increased understanding, but no firm commitments. For example, the methane initiative that was groundbreaking did not basically include anything about food, although we know that the meat industry is such a massive contributor, right? And food systems in general. So this is something that we can no longer afford. And that is also why EAT, together with partners from around the world, are now joining forces to work towards supporting the Egyptian governments for COP27 and also UAE for COP28 on getting food on the agenda, and also, I mean, serving food that a healthy, sustainable and 1.5 degree aligned menu as part of the next couple of COPs meetings. So that must happen. It's massive momentum building.
Yeah, it's a huge moment, isn't it? And it seems as though there is momentum there, which is really exciting. So my last question really is about your journey, really. I'm interested in what has most surprised you about the whole journey with EAT. Is it the way that you've achieved success? Is it the willingness of people to listen? Or are you surprised how much change is possible or how little change is possible? I mean, what are the things that you've gone, oh gosh, I didn't realize it was going to be quite like this?
That is I love that question, Stefan. You know what? I think the most notable about this journey is how obvious it is to people everywhere that we have to change and transform and rethink the current systems once they get this explained. It's so inspiring and encouraging, and also I guess what gets me out of bed every morning, that once you get people, I mean half an hour, and you just walk them through, they are like, but that is absolutely obvious. You are right. I mean,
why didn't I think of that?
No, but that is, it's like a light being turned on.
Yeah.
It's like an enlightenment moment for people. And it really also is what makes me confident and absolutely convinced that, yes, we can together. So I think what we have achieved together with a growing community of actors now working towards food system transformation over the past almost a decade is proof that this is happening so fast. We are still decades behind where the energy transition is now, but if we are getting there. I mean, changing energy infrastructure takes billions and takes years, but food is, I mean, it's fresh produce. It happens every day, and it's something that we all are caring about. And again, this is this massive, forceful entry point to bring people together for unprecedented collaboration. In Norway, we call this a dugnad, which is a Norwegian word which doesn't translate to any other language really, but it's a local community effort where everybody bring whatever they can or muster. If you can cook, you bring food. If you are the owner of the local hardware store, you bring paint. I mean, that kind of voluntarily effort where you come together and create something bigger that benefits all of the community. And this is literally what we need at the global level. And we are rolling. This is happening. So again, I mean, we are ending on a high note here because food unites, food excites, and there are so many synergies and win-wins if we look at the big picture and if we work together with science to guide us and guide our actions collectively.
Gosh, it's like a whole orchestra crescendo ending with you. You are brilliant and you are incredibly inspirational. Dr. Gunhild Sjöldan, founder and executive chair of EAT. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Stefan.
It's a great pleasure. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Tabletop Podcast. If you did, there are plenty more at foodmatterslive.com. So, for example, if you go to the site and search Feeding Britain, you'll find the episode where I interviewed Professor Tim Lang about the food challenges facing the UK. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.